From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
During the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, tens of thousands of women were raped. Many are now dying of AIDS.
In Palestine, the effect of the political oppression, continuous occupation and the siege is deeply affecting women and children.
In India, despite strong laws, we have new categories of crime against women, such as feticide and trafficking.
Today, on this International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, we'll speak with women from around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S.-Saudi relations face new strains after claims that charitable donations by the wife of the Saudi ambassador to Washington may have been passed on to two of the September 11th hijackers. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is examining reports that Princess Haifa al-Faisal, wife of Ambassador Prince Bandar bin Sultan, gave $15,000 and monthly payments of $2,000 to Osama Basnan and his wife to meet medical costs in the United States. Basnan was a friend of Omar Bayoumi, whose contacts with Khalid Almidar and Nawaf al-Azmi, two of the hijackers who crashed an aircraft into the Pentagon, are being examined in a U.S. congressional inquiry into the financing of the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were from Saudi Arabia. Congressional leaders said the U.S. should investigate the allegations even at the risk of damaging relations with Saudi Arabia. Richard Shelby, outgoing vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, told NBC Television the FBI ought relentlessly to pursue these leads anywhere they go. In Iraq, UN weapons inspectors are heading back to Baghdad for the first time in 4 years. 18 specialists will fly into the capital from Cyprus and prepare for their first field mission, scheduled for Wednesday, to search for weapons of mass destruction. In the northern Nigeria city of Kaduna, funerals are taking place today following the deaths of over 200 people in violence linked to the Miss World Beauty Contest, which has now been relocated to London. It's estimated more than 1,000 were injured, more than 11,000 made homeless, in clashes between Christians and Muslims. A newspaper article about the pageant that offended Muslims sparked the violence. More than 20 churches and 8 mosques have been burnt down in the city, as well as a number of hotels. The West Coast Longshoremen's Union and shipping companies announced yesterday an end to a long and bitter labor dispute. In October, dock workers were locked out of the West Coast ports by management, and the Bush administration intervened by invoking the Taft-Hartley Act. Both management and labor claim victory. The contract, which must be voted on by the 10,500 rank-and-file members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, awards workers significant increases in pay and benefits, including the continuation of full medical coverage. The agreement also gives the shipping companies and terminal operators the ability to modernize operations with new technologies such as barcode scanners and integrated computers that will make the ports speedier and more efficient. In the most sweeping move in a decade to loosen industrial air pollution rules, the Bush administration plans to exempt older coal-fired power plants from having to meet stringent new anti-pollution rules that were developed under President Clinton. Under Bush's proposal, companies will be allowed to do extensive maintenance on older facilities without triggering tighter emissions curbs. The announcements come after electrical utilities gave more than $16 million to congressional candidates in this year's election, two-thirds of that money going to Republicans. The U.S. government may soon have to undertake its largest environmental cleanup ever to clean up 16,000 inactive military areas of unexploded munitions, including chemical and biological weapons. If not properly cleared, the munitions could pollute between 30 and 40 million acres, an area roughly the size of the state of Florida. With Democrats no longer blocking their way in the Senate, the Washington Post reports that President Bush and Republican congressional leaders plan a more vigorous push on their social policy agenda by trying to limit abortions, provide greater support to religious groups, and increase funding for sexual abstinence and fatherhood programs. Most men from Afghanistan, Algeria, Bahrain, Eritrea, Lebanon, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Qatar, Somalia, Tunisia, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen living in the United States must now provide fingerprints and detailed personal information to the government. The new rules affect non-citizen men born on or before December 2, 1986, who are intending to stay in the United States at least until January 10, 2003. Earlier this month, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced similar requirements for men at least 16 years old from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Sudan, and Syria. In Indonesia, Joyce Sadler, a U.S. nurse, and Leslie McCullough are expected to be released from jail next week after nearly 3 months in captivity. They've allegedly been assaulted, intimidated, harassed, and tortured. The women are going on trial today for violating their tourist visas. The Guardian of London reports the women plan not to contest the charges with the expectation that they will be released shortly. When they were first picked up by the Indonesian military, they were attacked by the military. Retired Colonel Lucio Gutierrez has won the presidential election in Ecuador. Gutierrez was one of the leaders of the coalition of indigenous peoples that toppled Jamil Mahuat in the year 2000. With nearly all votes counted, official results showed Gutierrez had obtained more than 54% of Sunday's vote against billionaire banana tycoon Alvaro Noboa, the country's wealthiest man. We'll have more on that story with a representative of the party of Lucio Gutierrez joining us in the studio. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move to our first story, an Israeli soldier on Friday shot dead a top UN official who was inside a clearly marked United Nations compound in Jenin. The British citizen, Ian John Hook, has become the first United Nations worker to be killed since the Second Intifada began 2 years ago. Israeli officials originally reported Ian Hook was caught in gun crossfire, but their story changed over the weekend when Israeli radio reported an Israeli soldier shot directly at the UN worker. Now the official Israeli story is that Palestinian gunmen fired on Israeli soldiers from within the UN compound. Soldiers thought Hook was holding a gun and opened fire. They now say it was probably his cell phone. The London Independent is reporting the Israeli army ignored repeated telephone calls from Hook pleading for a ceasefire so he could evacuate his staff from the UN compound where he was shot dead. The United Nations also says the Israeli army story is incredibly incorrect. The UN Relief and Works Agency's Paul McCann said, "We know we had control of the compound, there were no militants inside it, and there was absolutely no fire coming from inside it." The United Nations also says Israeli soldiers blocked an ambulance from getting to Hook after he was shot. Ian John Hook headed a multi-million dollar project to rebuild the Jenin refugee camp after Israeli troops razed the camp in April. An Irish peace activist who's living in Jenin, named Quiba Butterfly, was also shot on Friday. The United Nations, Ireland, and Britain have all called for independent investigations with both shootings. Quiba Butterfly joins us on the telephone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, how are you doing?
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what happened to you?
There was a partial military reinvasion of Jenin camp on Friday morning, and that consisted of a very heavy military force The soldiers came in tanks and jeeps, Apache helicopters and on foot, and came in shooting very erratically. They cordoned off about two blocks of the camp and made it into a closed military zone, which basically meant that anybody coming out of the front doors was at risk of being shot. There were clashes going on in which they were firing live ammunition, rubber bullets, stun grenades and tear gas at small groups of children in various parts of the camp, and that's where I was for about the first 2 hours of the morning. I then received a call from a friend of mine, a mother of a small girl who was ill and needed an ambulance brought into the camp. The Israelis were denying access to the ambulance, so she asked me to come down and negotiate personally with the Israelis. When I got down there with a Palestinian friend of mine who's a freelance journalist, we were both immediately arrested because we were told that we were violating a closed military zone, and brought to an alleyway where there were about 20 Palestinian men who had been very badly beaten. They had been arrested in house-to-house searches, and they were being held handcuffed and blindfolded. While in the alleyway, for a period of about 2 hours. One incident that I witnessed personally was about 200 metres down to our left was the UN compound. It wasn't under specific fire at that time. They'd been firing erratically in the whole neighbourhood. I saw Ian Hook come out with a very clearly marked big blue UN flag and waved it in front of an Israeli jeep, pleading for coordination and ensuring safe passage. For himself, his Palestinian international workers inside. The Israelis in the jeep said very clearly in English over a loudspeaker, "We don't care whether you're from the UN or wherever you are, fuck off and go home." I was released shortly afterwards. I was told that I was free to go. I tried to stay in that area, but I was told that I would be shot if I stayed in the closed military zone and physically pushed away. On my way back to the area in which I had come from, I passed the UN compound briefly again. At that point, because the coordination wasn't going well, according to Ian Hook, because the Israelis weren't allowing safe passage out for anybody, some residents of the community had made a hole in the cement wall in the back of the compound, and they were evacuating women and children out of that hole. I accompanied some of the children home who were being evacuated at that stage, and then walked up through a few alleyways about two blocks away from the compound to another part of the camp, attempting to get back to the mother of the child who had initially called me. When I came up to a road about two blocks away, which was outside of the closed military zone, I came across a big group of children who were standing about 100 metres away from two tanks, and they told me that a young friend of ours, Mohammed, had just been killed and that three small children had just been injured as well. One of them was severely brain damaged as a result of that. I engaged in dialogue with the soldiers who were still shooting in the air at that stage, imploring them to stop shooting live ammunition at small children. One soldier stopped shooting. Another APC subsequently drove up, though. The soldier lifted the hatch, pointed the gun at the children, and started shooting in the air. Most of them ran away at that stage. However, there were a few small ones still left in the road, and I tried to push them towards an alleyway, which was about 50 metres up to our left. We managed to get quite close to there. I turned around once to look at the tanks behind us because shooting was still going on, and I saw the soldier who had been in the APC that had just driven up pointing straight at me. I was then shot just at the mouth of the alleyway. The kids got up. I fell down, and they kept on shooting when I was on the ground. So I sort of crawled up, and then children dragged me the rest of the way and carried me to the hospital because an ambulance was prohibited access from getting into that particular area. While in the hospital, within about maybe 10, 15 minutes of being there, Ian Hook was brought into the emergency room. I'm not sure if he was dead on arrival or whether he had died within a few minutes of that, but he was pronounced dead about 5 minutes later. They couldn't resuscitate him. He died of two dum-dum bullets, so-called, which are signatory Israeli occupation forces bullets. They explode within you. They're designed to kill. They're funded by the American administration. And I also spoke to the drivers of the two ambulances, a UN, very clearly marked UN ambulance and a Red Crescent ambulance, and both were denied access in for a full 45 minutes. Ian Hook had to eventually be evacuated out of that same hole in the wall on a stretcher and carried through most.
Could you just say the last part a little bit slower? Sorry, we're having a little trouble understanding you. Quiba Butterley is speaking to us from the hospital in Jenin, where she was brought after she was shot, describing when Ian John Hook, who was head of the project to rebuild the Jenin refugee camp for the United Nations, was brought in. Go ahead.
Right by there, they've got a room filled with about 50 people, so I'm just trying to get it all out while the noise level's still down. While brought into the hospital, because the ambulance was prohibited access, you know, to anybody in the camp at that stage, I was in the emergency room for about 10 to 15 minutes, if even that, before Ian John Hook was then brought in. I'm not sure if he was dead on arrival or whether he died soon after that, because I had lost a bit of blood myself, so I was a little bit out of it. But he was pronounced dead a few minutes later of the two dum-dum bullets which exploded inside him. I spoke to both drivers, who are friends of mine. I've worked with them, you know, for the last few months on the Red Crescent ambulances and also the UN ambulances, which were very clearly marked. They were prohibited from coming into the camp. They drove very close to the closed military zone. One was blocked by a tank, another was blocked by a jeep. And both, in both cases, the soldiers threatened to open fire on the ambulances if they came in. So that was Friday.
Israeli radio is now admitting that an Israeli soldier shot directly at Ian John Hook.
They are, but they're also stating and claiming that there was Palestinian resistance coming from within the compound. Hello?
Yes, Palestinian resistance coming from within the compound.
Yes, from what I witnessed, that wasn't true. There had been resistance early in the morning from a few fighters in the camp. I witnessed personally the very small group who was fighting move to another neighborhood a good 2 hours before the Israelis opened fire again on the compound, before the sniper hit Ian. I know that pretty much for a fact. I mean, when I was shot myself, it was the same fighters who were fighting who actually carried me with some of the children to the hospital. There were no gunmen in the area of the compound at that time. There had been no gunmen inside the compound that morning. There had been resistance going on close to the compound, because a lot of the Israelis who were stationed in the camp were down in that area. It wasn't from inside the compound. And again, that was a good 2 hours before the Israelis opened fire into the compound.
At this point, what is the casualty rate as a result of what happened on Friday? You were shot, Ian John Hook, head of the UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency project in Jenin, was killed. You described a number of Palestinians who were beaten up.
A number of Palestinians beaten up, another 9-year-old child killed. He was shot through the left eye, it went out through his head, and about 7 others, as far as I know. Again, I've been flat on my back, so this is only hearsay, but about 7 others shot as well, most of them with exploding bullets as well, one in the stomach, one in the knee, etc. Again, you know, this is a standard day for Jenin. The massacre that was perpetuated in April really hasn't stopped. It's been the types of human rights violations and war crimes that were seen so blatantly in April go on an everyday basis, and I think it's just the fact that internationals were involved. You know, it's that Palestinian blood has been so cheapened that it doesn't normally get mentioned. This is nothing new, really. The hospital is normally jammed packed full of the casualties of, you know, the everyday struggle to survive in Jenin, where going to the market or to the school or to a mosque is a potentially suicidal act at this stage.
Do you feel safe in the hospital?
I feel safe, to be quite honest, anywhere in Palestine, you know, because I don't think that the safety here, you know, coming to live here, is really bravery in terms of looking after your own physical body. I feel that the danger zone is what it does to heart and to the soul here, which is heartbreaking, you know, getting to know and to love and to cherish a very resilient, generous, spiritual, very strong race of people, and watching them, you know, being picked off one by one, the victims of casual killings or targeted assassinations or just the daily humiliation and desecration and brutalization of them by a very heavy system of apartheid, you know, that is being imposed upon them by the fact that they're living in concentration camps. I think the hospital is as safe as any place to be in, and it's jam-packed with visitors at the moment, so that's great. But Jenin is Jenin, and it's very, very resilient.
Will Quiba Butterly, I want to thank you for being with us, Irish peace activist who is in Jenin speaking to us from the hospital. She was shot in the leg by Israeli soldiers on Friday. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to talk about violence against women all over the world. We'll be joined by a woman from Somalia looking at women in Rwanda and what happens after they were raped close to 10 years ago. We'll be speaking with a woman from Palestine, from Jerusalem, also with Indian policewoman, and we'll be speaking with a woman from Ecuador. This is the International Day Against the Elimination, for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Stay with us.
I remember my first trip alone on the Greyhound bus. A man who put his hands on me as soon as a knife fell. I remember when I was leaving how excited I was. I remember when I arrived, I didn't feel so well. I remember the teacher at school got me so sick, scared. I went into the bathroom and I threw up in my hair, and I could go on, but you know what? It just gets worse, and I should probably stop there. Girl, next time he wants to know what your problem is.
Hide and Seek by Ani DeFranco, and it was great to see her here last night in New York at the Beacon Theater, where she performed many of her new songs. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the International Day Against for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Over the summer, four women were killed by their soldier husbands stationed at Fort Bragg. Three of the soldiers were members of the Special Forces and had recently returned from fighting in Afghanistan. Lawyers, psychologists, and other experts say this reflects a growing problem of militarism and domestic violence in this country. Every 15 seconds, a woman is battered in the United States. Every 23 seconds, a woman is raped in South Africa. Every minute in Britain, police receive a call for assistance in situations of domestic violence. Almost half of all women in Bangladesh have been physically abused. Today is the United Nations International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. We're joined in the studio by four leaders in the struggle to eliminate that violence. On this day in 1960, three sisters, the Miramal sisters from the Dominican Republic, were assassinated. They'd been outspoken political activists against the U.S.-backed dictator Rafael Trujillo. The assassination shocked and enraged the nation, helped propel the anti-Trujillo movement. Within a year, the dictatorship came to an end. The sisters became known as the Unforgettable Butterflies and have become a symbol of both popular and feminist resistance. Their assassination inspired author Julia Alvarez to write her novel In the Time of the Butterflies. Latin American feminists declared November 25th an international day to end violence against women in the 1980s. The UN recognized that day in 1999. We're beginning our conversation today with Nadira Shaloub Kevorkian. Professor Shaloub Kevorkian is a professor of criminology at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, project director at the Women's Center for Legal Aid and Counseling, a key resource in the West Bank and Gaza for the defense of legal and social rights of Palestinian women. I know it was very hard for you to listen to that last segment, Nadira. You're here now for a few months in Los Angeles, though you're in our studio here in New York. And you actually have done work with women in Jenin, the refugee camp we just heard a report out of. Can you talk about your work and your response to what you just heard?
Well, it was very hard to hear it because it brought me back to Jenin and to the situation in Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, most of the areas in Palestine. And basically the hard part of it is to know that it's not stopping. People are continuing paying their lives. The oppression, the intimidation, the situation, the humiliation is not stopping. You know, it's just reminding me of my last visit. I'm still running a project in Jenin while in Los Angeles. I do it at night. I give counseling to a group of counselors who's working with women, girls and women in Jenin who are trying to understand, trying to do some voice therapy, trying to see whether we could create hope in such a hopeless situation.
You have done work with mothers of suicide bombers?
I've done work with mothers of martyrs, not with suicide bombers. But I've done work with mothers whose kids were shot and killed, minor kids, by the Israeli forces. And the work with those mothers were very, very important because, first of all, the voice of those mothers were never heard. People have a problem hearing those voices, and everybody thinks that mothers are always happy to lose their kids. Mothers are waiting to see their kids, martyrs, dying. And what I have found out in my group therapy, which is with 15 mothers of mothers of martyrs, minors, that women discourse is a peace discourse. Women discourse is a hope discourse. They were always searching for a way to save, to help, to stop the abuse. And it was very, very enriching to me as a therapist, as a criminologist, to know that it's not enough to look at the TV. It's not enough to see what the television is showing, whether it's the Israeli or the Palestinian. But you need to go there to hear the unheard voice, to hear the muted voice. And this is what I was doing with them.
And what are the mothers saying?
First of all, you know, you see some of the mothers feeling that they didn't protect their kids from going out to school, for example. So many of them were very angry at themselves that maybe I should prevented him from going to school that day. Maybe I should have prevented him from going to work. Some of them have a very, very serious problems, like, for example, going to the grave, talking to him, telling him, you can't sleep in here while I'm sleeping on my bed. Or, you know, it's so tough to hear them speaking. And their voice, again, is trying for now protect the other kids that are still surviving. Mainly, you know, if I would recall Imammar saying, you know, she was asking me, tell me, it never crossed my mind that I will lose my kid. And my son now is not my son alone. I wish he was my only son so that nobody would look at him as a martyr. At least I would keep him. I would preserve him. And for Imammar, she asked me whether, if she lost one, whether she's going to lose the rest of the family. And this fear and this paranoia of losing another one is making her doing lots of very, very insane things. But in the name of, and she was trying to protect the other kids.
Like what? Doing what?
You know, preventing her daughter from going back to school. And I tried to work with her on going, you know, she's 14-year-old. But she said, well, Ammar was 15-year-old on his way to school. And we lost him. So maybe I shouldn't let the 6-year-old is going to the kindergarten. No need to go to kindergarten. Maybe he should stay here. So many tough issues that are facing the mother. For example, Im Mahmoud has a very serious problem every time she sees the kids coming back from school. So she starts singing and crying. And it's affecting the whole family. The other kids are being really affected. She's not allowing anybody to be happy, to put music, to listen, to eat the food that Mahmoud used to eat. So there are so many in-depth issues that we don't look at it. And we ought, as an international community, as a people who really care, to listen to those voices that nobody have ever heard.
Now, you're an Israeli Arab.
I'm a Palestinian Israeli.
Palestinian Israeli. Can you talk about the distinction between the way I said it and the way you just said it?
Yeah, Palestinian Arab, Arab Israelis is a concept that was constructed by the Israeli government. I'm Palestinian who was born in Israel. I'm proud to be Palestinian and Israeli. And this is what I am. You know, the moment you put me as an Arab Israeli, it put me into a specific corner. And I like to be what I am. I'm Palestinian Israeli.
You also do work in the Palestinian community in the occupied territories and Jordan?
I do work both in Jordan, Palestine, and Israel on domestic abuse and mainly child sexual abuse and women killing.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, recently I'm doing a research funded by the UNIFEM Trust Fund that is looking in depth into court decisions both in Jordan and Palestine. In Palestine, I'm looking at the court decisions of the Supreme Court, and in Jordan at the court decisions of the Cassation Court, which is higher than the Supreme Court, looking at the way the court react and look at the issue of child sexual abuse, incest, rape, and indecent assault. Of course, in Palestine, I must state that the political situation is not allowing any court or any police officer, prosecutor, or judge to reach the place. This is why the situation is extremely complicated with the study in Palestine. While in Jordan, we managed to look at the court decisions. We found lots of problems not in the law, but more in the enforcement of the law, in the way judges react, in the way police officers, prosecutors collect data, in the way they mute, they silence the voice of victims of sexual abuse.
How are those voices muted?
For example, when you look at the issue of consent, non-consent, the Jordanian law prohibits the judge to look at issues related to the consent of a minor. While when you start reading the documents in the courtroom, you see that they're looking at, was she consenting? Why didn't she disclose it? Why didn't she call for help? Nobody looks at the fact that if the uncle or if the brother or if the father is sexually abusing a child who never had the chance to voice out. I have a case that I looked in depth at the way she was reacting to her abuse. And this 10-year-old who continuously was raped by her uncle when she was 15, she had a baby. She didn't know what happened to her, and she ended up leaving the baby on the roof and going to sleep. Second day, she was accused of infanticide, and she's in jail now, while nobody managed to prove that it was the uncle who raped her, because they said if she accepted it for 5-6 years, that means that she consented, that means that she didn't call for help, that means that she is a dishonorable woman, and so on. So the problem sometimes is the law, because the Jordanian law, for example, would execute somebody who raped a minor, and the judges are so scared. I did a legal colloquial in Jordan. I brought this material to the judges, to the meeting. They were stunned by their own words, by the way they put things, by the way they analyze things. It's gender biased, gender discriminating, and it's so unfair to the girl child.
Nadira Shaloub Kevorkian, professor of criminology at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, working now in Los Angeles. We're also joined by Archana Ramasundaram. She, at a very young age, made an uncommon career decision, joined the Indian Police Service. More than 20 years later, she is now joint director of the Central Bureau of Investigation, and works, among other issues, against discrimination against women. As you listen to Professor Shaloub Kevorkian describe the situation in the occupied territories in Jordan, in the Palestinian community, what similarities do you see as you work on violence against women in India?
She just now mentioned that there are problems with the enforcement of laws also. I quite agree with her, because after joining the police service, this has been my impression as well, that in spite of having very strong laws, constitutional as well as major laws, we have a very, very poor enforcement. And not only we have the problem of inadequate enforcement, whatever manner the police are enforcing the laws are also sometimes not very friendly with the victim. And she also mentioned about the problem of the procedural problem while investigating and prosecuting rape cases, such as the problem of consent. Yes, this problem has been faced in other countries as well. And recently, I mean, we had a very welcome sign in our countries, because the rape laws are being made quite victim-friendly. And earlier days in the courtroom, they would also go into the previous background of the women. They would say she is of immoral character, and it would be very difficult to prove the charge of rape by her. But now it is being decided, and it is pending before the Indian Parliament, that there is absolutely no need to go into the background of the women. It has to be treated as a separate incident and prosecuted in that manner only.
Can you talk about the most common sources of violence against women in India?
We do not have a crisis situation, let me put it like that. But then we do have, a substantial degree of violence. Some of it has come over the century. I would categorize it into two: violence within the family and violence outside the family. You must have heard about the torture related to dowry and dowry deaths in the country, the bride killings, which is the popular word for that. We have very strong laws on paper, but in reality it is very difficult to prove such cases, and most of the time...
Explain what they are.
For instance, it is a part of the tradition. And sometimes when the issue is brought before the family members, to start with, nobody would directly go to the police. The first issue would be settled within the family. I have noticed, both as a woman and also as a police officer, that sometimes we blame the victim herself. We expect her to put the family prestige and honor in the front and then try to adjust with these problems. So the counseling, is preferred to the prosecution, and sometimes it is not in the interest of the victim.
But explain the connection between the dowry and a killing.
There have been cases where if the demand of dowry is not met, the woman is tortured and sometimes killed. And there are instances where the torture is indirect and done in such a manner that she is compelled to commit suicide. So, as a police officer, we have been investigating such cases where the suicides are committed by women in such suspicious circumstances, where you feel that the dowry might have been one reason why she was driven to this act.
You have a lot of work to do, I would assume, inside the workplace as well as taking on these issues, being in a very male field. You are an Indian police officer. In fact, you're now the joint director of India's Central Bureau of Investigation, which is like the FBI in the United States. You're India's John Mueller, I guess you could say.
I wouldn't know about that. But yes, that is correct. And there's one aspect of policing which I have always felt uncomfortable with, that we are almost segregating gender issues within the police system also. Whenever there is a problem, if there is a public criticism, there is an effort to provide cosmetic solutions, such as you have a crime against women cell, you have a dowry, anti-dowry cell. So what happens, you put the, you again compartmentalize gender issues. So there would be a cell and the rest of the enforcement machinery can just carry on.
So that it's not considered, for example, just a murder. It is put in a special category.
No, if it is a murder, if it is a dowry death, definitely it would be a murder case. But my approach is, why allow the situation to develop to that extent? So if it is a torture, it has to be handled as a torture, irrespective of the fact whether it is within the family or outside the family.
Police brutality is a major issue in the United States. People call the police in to protect, for protection, and then they find that the police brutalize them, particularly communities of color in the United States. Is this an issue in India?
The image of the police in India also is not all that good, I must admit. There have been various efforts from the department. For example, we have been conducting gender-sensitive training programs. There has also been an effort to mainstream the gender issues. But I must admit that a lot needs to be done even now.
Mm-hmm. And now, after September 11th, as head of the equivalent of the FBI here, are you working more and more with the U.S. FBI?
Yes, we have been coordinating with international organizations, even otherwise, because the Central Bureau of Investigation also functions as the NCB, that is the local Interpol unit for the country. So we are the interface for rest of the world. So within the country also, for example, if a particular police agency in India wants to have some interaction with the Interpol or with any foreign police, they go through us. So in that manner, we have been interacting with the U.S. or other state, other countries' police in the past also. But yes, definitely in recent years, this interaction has definitely become much more intense.
And on the issue of the connection between militarism and violence against women, do you see that in your own work? For example, when militarism escalates, now we're in a time of war with a so-called war on terror. In the United States, for example, we see 4 women are killed this summer at Fort Bragg by soldiers who've returned from Afghanistan, 3 of them in the special forces. Do you see any kind of trends like that when there is war abroad, there is more of an acceptance of violence?
See, we have been facing the problem of terrorism for more than a decade. So for India, it is not a new phenomena. And there have been occasions where, you know, in the interest of fighting war against terror and taking up strong measures against terrorists and suspects, it is quite possible that the police agencies may use certain high-handed methods, which at times may go against the civilians. And among civilians, children and women are the most vulnerable sector, so they tend to suffer. It happens occasionally, but I would not rate it as a major issue.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Nadira Shaloub Kevorkian, professor of criminology at Hebrew University, and Archana Ramasundram, who is the head of the Joint Bureau of Criminal Investigation in India, head of the the Central Bureau of Investigation?
The Central Bureau of Investigation, and I'm a joint director. There is a director, Central Bureau of Investigation. It is headed by a more senior officers.
And when we return, we're going to speak with Rakia Omar, who is a Somali human rights activist who's been doing a good deal of work in Rwanda. And we'll also be speaking with a leader from Ecuador and ask her about the Ecuadorian election that took place yesterday. Stay with us.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes. Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me.
Tracy Chapman, Behind the Wall, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. We're looking at violence against women. Today is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, so declared by the United Nations in 1999. The women we're speaking to today will all participate in a conference at the United Nations today. Rakia Omar joins us in the studio, a Somali human rights activist, director of African Rights, an NGO working to bring the voices of survivors to the center of the human rights debate. Rakia Omar is currently working with UNIFEM on a project documenting the experiences of rape victims in the Rwandan genocide. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very nice to have you in our studio. I've talked to you a great deal over the years on the telephone.
Yes, it's been a pleasure for me too.
Can you talk about your work right now in Rwanda?
Yes, we've been documenting the genocide in Rwanda for the past 8 years, since it started in April 1994. I was there myself during 2 months of the genocide in May and June of 1994. So for me personally, the genocide is a real-life experience, something I saw and experienced with my own eyes, not just something I saw on television or read in the newspapers. We've written a great deal of books and reports and engaged in lobby and advocacy on a range of issues connected with the genocide. In recent years, we've been working very closely with women who were raped, Tutsi women against whom the genocide was targeted. Unfortunately, many of them are HIV positive. And we are, and time is running out for them, obviously, given the fact that they have HIV or AIDS. And we are now trying to awaken the community, both within Rwanda and internationally, to the urgency of their situation, both in terms of practical support and in terms of their determination to document their experiences and to bring their persecutors to trial, both within Rwanda and at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, based in Arusha, Tanzania.
There's very little attention paid to that, that there are these trials that are going on right now. How many people are on trial?
In Arusha?
Yes.
I think the number of people who have been indicted are now somewhere in the range of about 50 or to 60. Of course, a lot of them have not actually been arrested despite the indictments, because they have not been either located or they have not been handed over by the governments in the countries where they are living. Most of the planners and organizers of the genocide fled Rwanda in the wake of the defeat of the forces of genocide in July 1994. It's generally the foot soldiers, the more minor participants who are imprisoned in Rwanda. But the key architects and organizers, the military officers, the media people, the civil servants are living abroad, many of them in comfortable positions, protected by foreign friends who either protect them for out of friendship or who share some of the beliefs that led these people to kill tens and thousands of their fellow citizens.
And of course, for people in the United States for whom Africa enters their consciousness only very rarely, if they only get information about it from the mainstream media, because there's almost no attention on the entire continent. The knowledge, how do you work with the knowledge of what the U.S. involvement was in 1994, Rakia Omar?
Well, I think, unfortunately for Rwanda, when the genocide began in April 1994, the Clinton administration, I think, was haunted by two primary considerations. One was the legacy of what happened in Mogadishu, Somalia, and where 18 U.S. soldiers were killed, and where the experience of intervention turned out to be a very bitter one for the United States. So Clinton was determined that the United States was not going to get involved in another Somalia. And so not getting involved was, I think, the force that drove U.S. policy. And of course, at the time as well, the U.S. was under considerable pressure to get involved in Bosnia. There was a lot more domestic pressure for intervention in Bosnia than there was in Rwanda. So, of course, they were determined not to get involved in Rwanda so that there would not be ammunition for those who wanted U.S. intervention in Bosnia. So the U.S. basically discouraged the United Nations, I think, from doing more, from getting more involved, despite the fact that the genocide was literally unfolding under the very eyes of the international community. So I do think it's quite ironic that President Clinton continuously says that he was not aware of what was happening. He's visited Rwanda two or three times and has claimed to have been unaware of the nature of the killings and the speed of the killings, and this is just not true.
In fact, wasn't the State Department, Madeleine Albright, and all the various officials specifically instructed not to use the term genocide because that would trigger international conventions and they would have to deal in a different way?
Yes, they were told not to use the word genocide. Again, I think this was to a large extent driven by considerations that related more to Bosnia, because a decision had already been made that there would be no U.S. intervention in Rwanda. And so the use of the word genocide was considered unadvisable, as I said, so as not to provide ammunition for those campaigning for a more robust involvement in Bosnia.
Uh-huh. And you're also well known here for, well, you when you were in the United States, you worked at Human Rights Watch, or what was known as Africa Watch, at the time, and you vehemently opposed the U.S. Invasion of Somalia in 1993 and broke ranks with the organization and ended up going and founding Africa Rights.
Yes. When I was with Africa Watch in December 1992, my colleague and I, Alex Dewal, took a very strong stand against U.S. intervention in Somalia because we felt that it would make a bad situation worse, and that the U.S. was not armed with sufficient knowledge of the local situation in order to make that intervention both timely, responsible, and effective. And unfortunately, our words turned out to be true, because within 6 months, the UN-U.S. intervention was in serious trouble, and it cost the U.S. 18 lives, and I think left also an extremely negative experience for the U.S. as far as involvement with crises abroad is concerned. And, well, we saw the result of that in Rwanda in April 1994.
What is the connection, Rwanda, Somalia?
Well, I think the connection is that the U.S. was vehemently opposed to any involvement with Rwanda because it feared a repeat of what happened in Somalia, a repeat where U.S. forces, should they intervene in Rwanda, would get bogged down in local politics, would possibly get involved in crossfire between opposing armies, and where the U.S. Would lose some of its soldiers, as happened in Somalia in 1993. So I think there is absolutely no question about the fact that the U.S. experience in Somalia very heavily influenced the U.S. decision to have no involvement with Rwanda.
And now, finally, the children of the women who have AIDS who were raped during the Rwandan genocide, what happens with them?
Well, unfortunately, a very large number of the women who were raped repeatedly and under horrific circumstances, and raped by the very men who had literally destroyed, wiped out their families. Many of them have died. Many more are affected with HIV, and they have also given birth to children of those militia men. Sometimes the children are HIV positive. Unfortunately, sometimes they are not. But even where they are not, they have no networks of support. AIDS victims in Africa survive to a very large extent through the support of the family and friends. It's the only form of social security we have in Africa. But these women are alone. They don't have family. Their families were wiped out in the genocide. So they are not only bereft of resources and practical support, they are very ill, and they don't have anyone to leave the children to. So I think apart from worries about how they are going to survive until they die, they are haunted by fear that their children will be left on the streets. And one of the things that I'm hoping to achieve through this UNIFEM project, which is going to highlight the problems of these women and attempt to advocate on their behalf, is to encourage international support for the victims of rape in Rwanda and for their children.
Rakia Omar with Africa Rights, working with the rape victims from the Rwandan genocide of 1994, almost a decade later. It's hard to believe. We're also joined in the studio. Rakia Omar will be joining Daris Solis Corion and other women at the United Nations today on this day for the elimination of violence against women. Daris Solis Corion is vice mayor of Cuenca in Ecuador, and she was instrumental in instituting the city's Equal Opportunities Plan, which it provides for gender mainstreaming in all areas of Cuenca's public policy. But before we talk about that, you are with the party of Lucio Gutierrez, who has just won the presidential election yesterday, and I wanted to know your response to this victory.
Bueno, creo que comparto con la inmensa mayoría de ecuatorianos de encontrar en esto una situación alentadora para los cambios que el Ecuador requiere.
Like the majority of Ecuadorians, I'm very pleased. I do think that Lucio Gutierrez will implement the changes that are needed in our country.
Y que están centrados en cuatro grandes temas: la lucha contra la corrupción, la reactivación económica, la necesidad de políticas sociales y la democracia política.
The main changes that are needed are an end to corruption, an economic reactivation, democracy, and social changes.
Gutierrez had a great deal of support among women. Why?
Muchas mujeres apoyaron a Gutierrez. ¿Por qué?
Porque el conjunto de movimientos sociales en Ecuador venimos luchando desde hace varios años por estas transformaciones, y dentro de ellos el movimiento de mujeres y el movimiento indígena son tal vez los movimientos que más dinámicamente han aportado a este cambio desde la base de la sociedad.
Many women have been very active in trying to exercise social change together with the indigenous people, and that's why from the beginning he was a suitable candidate for us. We've been working on these issues for very long.
You're the vice mayor of the third largest city in Ecuador, Cuenca. How are you working there to prevent violence against women? 6 out of every 10 women in Ecuador are violated in one way or other.
El Ecuador conquistó en los años 90 un marco legal favorable con la existencia de una ley específica. Y de colocar
in the 1990s, we got an appropriate law to deal with violence against women.
Y de colocar estos derechos también en la Constitución del Estado.
And we were also able to introduce these laws into the Constitution of Ecuador.
Pero esta misma década de los 90 nos enseñó que es absolutamente insuficiente los cambios legales.
But we've learned that the legal changes are not enough.
Si no están acompañados de políticas públicas integrales, y es lo que este rato estamos trabajando a nivel del gobierno central y de los
and
gobiernos locales.
And that's why we need public policies to instrument to implement those legal changes, and we've been working via the local governments and the national government as well.
What are the most important laws that protect women?
¿Cuáles son las leyes más importantes de protección para la mujer en Ecuador?
Bien, por un lado, el haber conquistado dentro de la Constitución que los principales derechos de la mujer estén mencionados como derechos constitucionales.
On the one hand, to mention women's rights as constitutional rights in the Constitution of Ecuador.
Y una ley específica, la expedida en el 95, la ley por la eliminación de todas las formas de violencia contra las mujeres.
And in 1995, we had a specific law to eliminate all kinds of violence against women, approved.
Well, I hate to leave the conversation there, but that's all we have time for. I want to thank all of the women who have joined us today on this program. We were just speaking with Doris Solis Corion, vice mayor of the third largest city in Ecuador, Cuenca, Ecuador, and she is with the Pachacutic New Country Movement, which is the party of Lucio Gutierrez, who has just been voted the new president of Ecuador, and he will take office in January. All these women will be gathered at the UN today for this International Day for Elimination of Violence Against Women. That does it for the program. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can get a copy of today's show by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogueira, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Say, hey, sweetheart, come here.